Hello, friends. I'm Rosie Acosta, your host and guide on this journey to self-discovery and radical love. I've walked a path filled with challenges. Growing up in East LA during the 92 LA riots, it left me searching for meaning, for mentors, for a way to truly understand the purpose of life. But you know what I found? The power of conversation. As a first-gen Mexican-American, these conversations became my compass, offering insight, support, and an endless amount of inspiration. So I decided to create a space where we can share these conversations with you, our community. And that's how the Radically Loved podcast was born. Join me as we dive into topics like mindfulness, spirituality, self-love, and the keys to overall healthy living. I'm joined by my dear friend, fellow author, producer, and teacher, Tessa Tovar.
Hi, I'm Tessa, and I'm grateful to be part of this community because it teaches me so much about what it means to be human. Ever since I was a little one, I was always asking my dad the deeper questions in life. Why are we here? What happens when we are gone? What is the purpose of life? I love this show because I get to ask the questions that cut right to the meaning of life. I've learned that no matter how much we want the path to be clear or straightforward, it rarely is. And that is actually part of the beauty that creates a radically loved life.
Please do us a favor, share the episodes you love with your friends, and leave us a review. Together, we'll learn how to create a life that's truly, deeply, radically loved. Let's begin. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Radically Loved podcast. I am so honored for today's guest. He's been a friend for a long time, and I want to be able to talk about our friendship too, because he's made some very impressionable memories for me, just as a teacher and as a person. So I'm so excited to have Sa DeSimone back on the show. Everybody, please welcome, insert clap track. So Sa is a spiritual guide. He's a meditation teacher. He's a transformational speaker. He's a best-selling author. What really impresses me the most about Sa is his ability to show up always authentically, vulnerably, and with his whole heart. Every single time I see him or I come across his feed, he's always so wholeheartedly present and honest. So thank you so much for being here.
Oh my goodness. And what an introduction. Thank you. I am so honored to be here too. Thank you, my darlings. Thank you. And this is work in progress, you know? Work in progress. Like literally, it wasn't always like this. I think, I've always made friends really easily. That was never a problem for me. But I think the authenticity, the vulnerability, the deep intimacy right away, these are all things that deep self inquiry and, you know, really diving into all the aspects of myself that I don't like has helped me to arrive at a place that I feel comfortable being who I am, that I don't necessarily hate the parts of my biography that I didn't like before. You know, I think that's a really important thing, that we have to arrive at a point where we are no longer disgusted by aspects of our biography that triggered us, that we're not proud of. This is a big thing. I think a lot of people who are not showing up vulnerably, authentically at any place, it's because there's still aspects of their story that they're not proud of. And shit, there's parts of my story that I'm not proud of, but am I fighting with the fact that it happened? Or am I accepting and making a vow to not do it again? And that vow to not do it again then propels me forward, leads the way for a new way of operating, which is with acceptance, with grace, with sweetness. And that literally, you know, helps me to just be constantly authentic, vulnerable. Does that make sense?
Yeah, 100%. Well, the way that you show up, always giving us permission to radically accept ourselves. When I think about radical acceptance, I think about you, because you're constantly, and you're shining the light on yourself. You're putting yourself as the example. And I think that what that does is it gives us permission to feel that. You know, every time I see you or I see you on my feed, it's always the same. Like, you have such a consistency about you. And I think that's really important when we're talking about friendships or we're talking about building a community. I think it's important for us to really recognize those people in our lives that show up in that way, because it really gives us permission. Like, the way that you show up allows us to put those barriers down, right? Because a lot of people, we go around, you and I, we've talked about this before, when we see each other, it's like, what's really, how are you really? It's not, we don't go into like surface level, like, oh, everything's good. It's like, I am going through it right now. Like, I'm in a dark place. Like, I'm having a really hard time. And we just go in. And I think time and time again, you know, for me to be able to express that to you is your ability to express that to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love that. It's so necessary. And I think the consistency that you see in me, it's a consistency to become liberated, to become free, to show up, you know, unafraid of how people will see me, or how people will interpret me. You know, I think that's the biggest thing, how people will interpret me. But what you and I allow each other, which I write about this in a book, we allow each other to not be who we were yesterday, today. We are constantly calling forth the new Rosie, the new Sa. We are constantly celebrating that Rosie is changing. We're constantly celebrating that Sa is changing. And Tessa, I, you know, just getting to know you now, but celebrating the changing nature of all of life is such a necessary aspect of becoming a good friend. I think a lot of people who don't, who have a hard time making friends, who have a hard time keeping friends, or who have a hard time deepening their friendships, it's because they're expecting people to stay the same. They're expecting it to just be the same old, I want you to play the role that you play in my life, and I want that to be the script that you operate under. And if you go off the script, I'm going to be triggered. If I'm triggered, then you're cut. And relationships, 10 years of relationship go down the drain. And I'm like, no wonder why there's a loneliness epidemic, because we're just not trained to understand that impermanence and the changing nature of all things is inevitable. It's happening constantly. We're just not present enough, and we're not patient enough to realize that it's constantly changing. And when we're present and patient with the changing nature, then we're actually able to navigate the grief that comes. While Rose is no longer the person she used to be for me, while Sa is no longer the person he used to be for me, but there is something else being born. Can I be with what's coming up? Can I allow the new version of Rose, the new version of Sa, to be born, to blossom in a whole new way? And then can I meet that with fresh eyes, with beginner's mind? We are so hung up with our preconceived ideas, with our conditioning, with our biases. And a lot of our biases and our conditioning predates us, didn't start with us. It's things that have been in our lineage before we even were Rosie, before we were even Tessa or Sa. You know, you can look at from a scientific perspective. There's a lot that gets passed down through chemistry, and there's a lot that gets passed down through, if you look from the Eastern perspective, through karma. So there's a lot that makes up the process that we call Sa, the process that we call Tess, the process that we call Rosie, that predates us, that didn't start with us. But it's our responsibility to stop the cycle of loneliness, to end the epidemic of loneliness by choosing to say, I allow Rosie to completely be different than she was. I want to walk into your house and just see you totally new. You know, that, like, allowing that changing nature to be part of our daily vernacular. Am I making sense?
Yeah, no, 100%. And it's interesting, right, to be able to see it from that perspective, or to frame it in that way, because something that you pointed out that really resonates with me, and I know it resonates with Tessa too, this idea of like grief, right? Grieving this not only grieving the part of you that's no longer you, but also in the other person, like grieving the fact that Sa is not the Sa that I knew a year ago, 5 years ago. This is a different person, right? So to give myself the permission to grieve that and to be open to this new person. I think that takes a lot of courage, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, Tessa and I have gone through many iterations, you know, we've gone through many iterations of this podcast about, you know, of how we've structured this, and her and I have been working together now for, I don't even know how many years, Tessa, it's been like,
almost 10.
Wow.
What? Wait, well, I mean, I'm going all the way back to the beginning of our relationship.
Okay. So yes, for a decade, we've known each other, but working together, I would say maybe like 7-8 years. So probably close to about that. But it's interesting that this sort of idea, how even our relationship has changed over time. You know, it went from, I was the teacher, she was the student, and I was very sort of rigid in that, like, this is my role. This is who I am. I don't want to overstep any boundaries, but we just kept sort of like cross mingling these boundaries, and little by little it became, well, okay, now we're working together. Well, but now we're friends, but now I'm sharing stuff too. And it's like, okay, so now we're friends. I guess now we're friends. And how does this evolve? And now we're, it went from, okay, she's working for Radically Loved. Now we're working together. It's like the evolution of that. And I think both of us being open to your point of letting people grow within themselves is important, right? If I was afraid of, oh, my student is going to now no longer be my student, and she's my student, and I have to keep her in this role, and like, I can't let her, you know, push out of this little box that I've built. And she could have been doing the same to me, right, Tessa? I mean, she could have kept me in this box and just kept the relationship as it is. And look, in some circumstances, I'm sure that that's fine, but I really feel like what your whole point is with the art of relating and connecting from the heart is it speaks to more of our ability to be open and our ability to be more accepting and our ability to be connected from that place, that more authentic, aware, awake place.
And what a beautiful example. What a beautiful example they use with like moving from teacher to student, to working together, to friends, like allowing all the versions of Tessa to blossom and to bloom. And you doing the thing that we call in the book radical friendliness and being a sacred friend, which is to water the seeds of goodness, to water the seeds of wisdom, of compassion, of love, of joy in Tessa's heart. These seeds are already inside of us. All the seeds are, everything is already inside of us. And then it becomes really evident when you start to look at our relationships as us being gardeners to each other, how you are then watering the seeds that are already in Tessa. We all could use a little gardening. You know, we are able to offer ourselves the enough water and enough sunlight to blossom and bloom and sprout the seeds of liberation inside of our hearts. However, because nothing exists from its own side, because we don't exist independently of each other, because everything's in context with each other, interdependence, interconnection, means what? That us watering each other's gardens, it's something that's going to happen regardless of our being, of us like saying, I'm doing this or not. Oftentimes we're watering things for people that we wish we didn't. Oftentimes we're watering the seeds of anger, of rejection, of abandonment. Oftentimes we are calling for things in people that we wish we didn't. But in the regards of you, Rosie and Tessa, what I'm hearing, which I find so beautiful, is you have consciously and unconsciously watered the seeds of growth, of beauty, of spontaneity, of courage, of brilliancy, of power, of boldness, of authenticity in Tessa. And you not only did that, but you watched it grow. And when it did grow, you were actually able to participate in the harvest. And look at you guys doing this thing together. So it's so beautiful. And in the book, we say this briefly, not briefly, I just add this thing to it. There's a core five, and then out of the core five, there's a 15. And we should be really looking at the people who make up our core five, who are the true diehards, who are the people who are there for you in the plane of secrets, who are the people who are there actually actively, consciously watering the seeds of boldness, authenticity, freedom, joy in your heart. They're there in it. And then in the 15, those are people who will actually travel across the country, across the world if your mother dies. They are the people who you can call last minute and say, can you babysit my child? These are the people who will come over to your house and clean up if you've been depressed for a while. Now, out of the 15, you have the 50, which are the people who will come to the big birthday bash or the big housewarming party. And then out of the 50, then you have the 150, which is the larger circle, which is what the Dunbar research shows. It's our cognitive capacity can't surpass 150 people. So we can only truly know 150 people. So it's amazing when we have this framework, because we become much more intentional about the people in our lives and how we spend time with them. And the 150 are people who will come to that once in a lifetime event, funeral, wedding. Now, the reason why I say all this, because I imagine that for you, Rose, and for you, Tessa, you guys are in each other's either 5 or 15, either the core 5 or the core 15, because that is where you really are what they all, you know, what a lot of mystical tradition says you are. You are a reflection of the people that you spend the most time with. So that it's leading up to all the things that I'm saying are leading up to that understanding, but obviously based on what the research has to say about it.
I love that.
Do you know if you're getting enough magnesium? Because 4 out of 5 Americans aren't. And that's a big problem because magnesium is involved in more than 300 biochemical reactions in your body. Today, I want to talk to you about the most common signs to look for that could indicate you're magnesium deficient. Listen carefully to the end because there's a special offer happening and this could be exactly what you need. Okay, here we go. Are you irritable or anxious? Do you struggle with insomnia? Do you experience muscle cramps or twitches? Do you have high blood pressure? Are you sometimes constipated? There are dozens of symptoms of magnesium deficiency, so these are just a few of the most common ones. Now, here's what most people don't know. Taking just any magnesium supplement won't solve your problem because most supplements use the cheapest kinds that your body can't use or absorb. That's why I exclusively recommend Magnesium Breakthrough. It's the only full-spectrum magnesium supplement with 7 unique forms of magnesium that your body can actually use and absorb. All Bioptimizer supplements are best in class. If for some reason you feel differently, you can get a full refund, no questions asked. They are so confident that they offer 365-day money-back guarantee. Just go to www.bioptimizers.com/radically loved. Use the promo code radically loved 10. You can get gifts with your purchase. You can get 2 travel size bottles of Magnesium Breakthrough. Act fast. This is a limited time offer. Go to bioptimizers.com/radically loved and use the promo code radically loved 10.
So I've been following your work for a long time and just, you know, to echo everything that Rosie said in her introduction, just loving how vulnerable and authentic you are on, you know, with the world. I just love it. You know, I was talking about this earlier today in terms of I'm not someone who gets wrapped up in social media very easily. I actually go the opposite direction. But when you come across my feed, I stop and I watch what you're doing. And I think that speaks to, you know, your ability to just be you, unbridled, unapologetic. And there's something so, for me, it feels so inviting. And I think of, Saw's inviting me to dance. You know, I think about Saw's inviting me to celebrate my body. Saw's inviting me to love me as I am today. I don't need to change anything. I can just, you know, be sad and celebrate my body. I can be angry and celebrate my body. I can be happy and celebrate my body. So I love that you're out there doing that work. It's such a nice breath of fresh air to have in my feed. So thank you, number one, for that. And then number two, this is getting to the question that I want to ask you around being on this spiritual path. And I think part of the reason why you wrote and maybe even titled Spiritually We is when I step back and look at the work of spirituality, you know, more in like a global perspective, I guess I would say, in terms of it feeling like a healing and transformational journey it seems like we've gone through this epoch where it's very introspective, if that makes sense. You know, like a lot of us are like, oh, this is about me deepening my relationship with myself, knowing myself better. And what I love about your work, Saw, is that it's like, yeah, that's true, but don't stop there. That's not really enough. This is about more than just you and your own internal spirit experience. And yes, that's true too, but it's not just about us getting our needs met as individuals. It's about what's best for everyone. So I would love to just hear you talk more about that.
Mm-hmm. And that's such a great question. And I want to sort of create a foundation for understanding here for people in regards to the vocabulary that I use out in the world. I think us getting to know ourselves and deepening a friendship with ourselves is the work of personal development. And spirituality is the work of the community. When we go from I into we, this is when we are doing spiritual work. Because if you look at a common denominator across every mystical wisdom tradition in the world, those that have factually produced saints, sages, wizards, witches, who have actually factually produced liberated beings, those that you can walk into a room and they're sitting there doing nothing, and the quality of your inner world radically changes just by being in the presence of these beings, right? We've all met these people. We've all been, maybe I say we've all, I just have made so much of my life driven to be in these rooms with these people that I'm like, everybody's done that, right? But you know those friends in your life. You have those people in your life that relax you without doing anything, who can call you into the present moment without saying, calm down, you know, who can just ease, radically change the psychological and spiritual temperature of every room that they walk into because of the depth of their presence, right? So I just wanted to preface by saying that personal development is the precursor to spiritual development. Like, you can't go straight into Mother Teresa energy. You're going to burn yourself out right away. We do want to develop our capacity to arrive at a point where this is the Bodhisattva vow, which is a vow in Tantric Buddhism that says that our lives, the purpose of our lives is to be driven, is the drive of our lives is to support, to end suffering. And it's a big, bold vow, right? Because some people may say suffering may never end, but work towards ending it anyways, right? So it's a constant paradox, it's a contradiction, it's a twist. However, before we can get to that place of wanting to end suffering, wanting to be in the community, we really do have to address how we are doing, how we are feeling, what is within us that we are unwilling to meet. And sometimes we do need the community. Sometimes we do need to leave our cushion, leave our houses, and get back into the community, get back into the streets, get into all the areas that we are in contact with other people in order for us to have our stuff shown to us, right? So the point that I'm trying to make here is first develop your core strength, develop your capacity to get to know yourself, and then develop your capacity to care for other people. Now, oh, actually, I remember where I was going with this. It's this. There comes a point where our thinking, our feeling, our speaking, our acting, it's not only benefiting us, but it's benefiting all people. There is a point in spiritual liberation on the path of freedom that we are no longer driven by our own selfish motives, that our motives become selfless. And the common denominator across every spiritual tradition is compassion, is selfless. It's to arrive at a place where we are actively thinking about the benefit of others in such a way that it's actually benefiting us. But that's a fine line, and that's something that I'm working on it too. It's like, how do I arrive at a point where I'm not burning myself out from caring for patients at a hospital who are sick and dying, caring for the homeless youth here in Venice Beach, caring for my students, caring for all the facets of the impact that I'm creating, while simultaneously taking the time to care for myself. Still mastering that. I still arrive at points of burnout, still arrive at points where I really need to unplug and really do the work between me and me. However, in the work of Spiritually We, in the book, we do have a very clear equation that 50% of the path of liberation is done between you and you, which is done between your body, your mind, your heart, which includes your story, which includes your trauma, which includes your lineage, right? Now, the other 50% is between you and the community. You can't become free by only doing that 50% of the work where you walk into a room or you are at your house and you say, I'm so much more peaceful. I forgive myself. I love my body. And then you go off to meet a friend. And within a few minutes of being with that friend, you are triggered and you're judging their body. You're not forgiving them. You're not patient with them. So that is the 50-50 equation, where in order for you to have your realizations embodied and your realizations actualized truly in a somatic level, you got to test your material. So going from personal development into spiritual development is what creates that 100% equation of liberation that we speak about in the book. I went so far with that question, but I hope I answered it in some way or another.
You did. And that's why I ask questions like that, because I want you to go there. Rosie knows. I'm always like, how can I make the most nuanced question?
I know, I'm laughing. I'm like, let's see where this goes. She went there.
I love that. No, that was such a great question. And I love how you explained that, Saw, because so much of the practices that we learn, especially these more contemplative practices, the way that we bring them into the world is by interacting with other people, the way that we show up, the way that we are in service to other people, the way that we're in service to our community, the way we show up with loving kindness. And I really admire that about you and of all the teachers out there. I mean, to me, the way that you do it is, again, so genuine and so authentic and truly inspiring. You know, I've not really talked about the volunteer work that I'm doing too much on the podcast. I think I may have talked to you about this, when we saw each other last time, but doing work inside the prison system, you know, teaching mindfulness in the prison system. It's to me, what you're doing in hospice care, what you're doing with the homeless youth, you know, the work, you know, I'm doing in the prisons, it's like, you can't not have the spiritual we component as part of your practice, a holistic practice, right? Because it just feels like there's something missing, right? Especially for people like us, you know, it's like we want to be able to heal in our journey and help other people. And I think that this is a way that we do it. And for me, like, what you do is so courageous, because I know, you know, your story and you know, you lost your mother last, I feel like it was just last Christmas, but it was,
I mean, not this last one, the one
no,
before,
no, yeah. The year before, yeah. But to me, it's like, this has been an ongoing healing journey. I mean, you did the Camino de Santiago, right? Is that what it's called?
Yeah
Camino de Santiago, which I've always wanted to do my entire life. And you going, there's something really beautiful about that, because I'd known about, you know, your mom being ill, and I knew what you were going through, but to be able to experience that grieving process with you, and that, oh my God, I could get emotional just because it was like so beautiful. You know, to be able to like see you process that. And I think that just as like feeling beings, right? We feel people that we care about or even people that we don't even know, like we feel that empathy, that pain, the grief, the, you know, all the emotions that you went through. I mean, I can tell you your whole life the last year, but just from what you've shared, to me, it was so, so powerful. And when you started to volunteer in hospice care, to me, I'm like, oh, of course that makes total sense. You know, he just went through this really intense loss that like I can't even fathom, right? I can't even fathom that. And I feel like when we're able to go through these really deep
grieving experiences in a way, and I'd love to hear your thoughts, in a way it expands your capacity to hold this heaviness for other people, right? Because to me, I'm like, Saw is the perfect person to be doing this. Like, he is the perfect person to be out there. And I'm sure it's a lot and it's heavy. And I'm sure you have your own practices, and you've talked about this before too. You have to really focus on your own self-care, and sometimes you feel burnout, and I get that. I feel like that too. Sometimes when I come back from the prison, I feel so alive and I'm just so grateful and I'm full of love. And I'm just like, wow, like this life is beautiful. Like, we have to really just care for each other. And then there's other times I leave there and I'm heartbroken. Like, I am just heartbroken. And so, yeah, I'd be curious for you, like, first of all, like, sharing your journey of grief in the way that you have, and sort of being of service, and having that be, to me, it's like, you are living spiritually, we. Like, this is, you're living what you're teaching. I think that's so important, especially as a teacher, to be able to like do that, you know?
Oh, there's so many aspects of what you share that I want to like take apart and just like offer commentary and hopefully some wisdom in there. Well, I just, there's a couple of things that come to mind right away, which I find that would be necessary to share. It's, I could not have gotten through the grief. And I'm not through it, because I don't think grief is something that you let go. I think you just process its new iteration that visits you regularly. I've only gotten through it the season because I've had friends show up for me from every corner, literally. So the community has grieved with me. They have carried my burden with me. I was never alone with my burden. I think that's a huge, huge aspect of your capacity to transform trauma into, to see a glimmer, a slight little shimmer of a blessing in a trauma. It's if you have community around you, because the problem is we're thinking that we can do life alone. And grief, when you experience capital T trauma, like your mother dying tragically, and you just see the state of her body and how all the things, right? It's, and you have PTSD from it, so flashbacks and like nightmares and all the things, and your body's really ill and your memories is faint and you're foggy, and you still have to perform to keep the lights on, because you not only have the responsibility of your own life, but you pay grandma's rent and your aunt's health insurance and your father's rent and da-da-da. You know, I have a lot of responsibilities, so I had to keep going. But the only way that I was able to do it was by having the support of the community. Right. So when the community held me and I felt some degree of strength by being held by the community, then there was this urge towards service, to show up for people who have gone or are going through the exact experience that I went through in a hospital, where the doctors have no trauma-informed language, who cannot even deliver the news of saying your mother died, and washes their hands and walks away. Like, the inability to be present, to be compassionate, to be kind. And you talk to the medical staff, and they don't have trauma-informed language training, which is something that I've prided myself on and developed and created an entire body of work on that, to be able to show up for people, because it's been so awful, the experience that I've had, to be able to engage with the nursing staff in Brazil who were catty. And there was just a lot happened in that room around my mother's dying body. So when I decided to do the clinical spiritual care, to join the clinical spiritual care team at Cedars-Sinai as an intern, I know we said volunteer in hospice, but that's, you know, we see that in a variety of different ways. But for people who are curious about it, it's clinical pastoral education. It's training to become a chaplain in a hospital. And Cedars-Sinai has a robust, the hospital here in Los Angeles has a robust team, and it's incredible. One of my mentors said, go see if they will, if you could do the training with them there. And when I would walk into these patient rooms and I would see people having a hard time with the hospitalization, which is so traumatic, and in having a hard time with their familiar, with their parents or friends or family member dying, I was just like, I want to be a pillar of presence. I want to be a pillar of warmth in that space. I want to offer some degree of I want to be able to offer some degree of love in a space that feels so sterile and so clinical, where oftentimes people don't feel love in any way. So those two things, community supporting me and then me supporting the patients, the sick and dying at Cedars, has really cracked me open. And that leads me to speak about a point that's really alarming, right? Something that I notice at the hospital often, it's people are going through their complex oncology journeys, complex surgery, all aspects of their sickness or process of actively dying. And they're doing it oftentimes alone or with one person. It's so insane to me how far from support we have gotten, how far from community we have gotten. And I was writing this and doing this research for the book, right? Spiritually We. And then being in a hospital, I was like, oh my God, I'm living the experience. I am someone's friend here, which is amazing, but also heartbroken, Rosie, and heartbroken, Tessa, breaking because of the fact that, like, wow, what happened to us? That we are so removed from using the word, I need a friend. I need connection. I need someone to go through this process with me. I don't go through a single medical appointment alone. Never. I always have a friend or I have a family member who comes over. Literally, I won't go through that process by myself. And then you look at the statistics, right, that we have in the book. In the recent years, over 60% of young adults have shared that they experience serious loneliness, you know? And then two out of every five people in America, this is one of the largest loneliness research in America, report that their relationships are not meaningful. And in recent years, all these stats are recent, suicide rates have gone up 30%. So you look at those rates, and now I have the context of being in a hospital. I'm like, oh my God, it makes sense. People are dying alone. People are alone through the hardest times in their lives. Why? Because we forgot that the word need isn't a weakness. We forgot that the word, I need a friend, I am lonely, it's not a weakness. We forgot, or some of us don't even know, that when we feel lonely, it's a cue like hunger. We are not understanding that, okay, when I'm hungry, when I feel hungry, I walk over to the fridge or I get delivery on an app. But when I feel lonely, what do? We masturbate, we smoke a cigarette, we smoke a joint, we drink, we watch TV, we scroll on social media, a phone. We're on our phones. Literally, the phone is, it's literally severing our capacity to say, I need a friend. I need connection. And it's leading to these crazy statistics. And then it's leading to awful experiences where people are dying alone. So what I want to offer with all this that I just said is, when loneliness strikes, act the same way that you would act by taking a nap, the same way that you act by eating something, by drinking something. I want you to realize that this is not some woo spiritual psychobabble. This is scientific evidence that loneliness is a cue, a biological cue like hunger. And if you're not nourishing yourself with connection, you will starve yourself of a vital nutrient. This is factual evidence. Now, one more stats, one more scientific piece, which I am so grateful I was able to talk to so many different amazing experts in the book. loneliness is processed, chronic loneliness is processed in the brain the same way as physical pain. So social pain, like rejection, abandonment, shame, loneliness, all of these social pains are processed in the body the same way as physical pain. And what happens when we have physical pain? We want it to go away right away. We want to numb. We want to put a Band-Aid on it. We want to drink a pain medication. We want to do everything we can for it to go away. Now, when you look at the brain of someone who's chronically lonely, we have a reward system, all of us do, in our brain. And I'm not a scientist by no means, but I have scientific language because I've been putting this book together for so long and talking to all these amazing people, different neuroscientists, different, all kinds of amazing people in the scientific field. And we all have a reward system in our brain. But the brain of a lonely person, someone who's chronically lonely, their reward system is heightened. And when the reward system of someone is heightened, when they taste a little something that eases the pain, they become highly addicted to it right away. So I'm just building the framework to advocate for us to be able to together end the loneliness epidemic and understand that connection is a nutrient that we need, just like food and water and sunshine and sleep. You know, am I making my point across?
Yes. Loud and clear.
Yes. Loud and clear.
Over here. Oh my God. I wondered if it's okay. I was hoping we could spend a little bit of time. Another theme of the book is like drawing out the culture of us versus them. And I think there's nowhere in the world that I look that it's so much more prevalent in terms of judgment is around the homeless population. And so I love to hear about your work with working with the homeless youth. And I just think it just always makes me so emotional because I think there's just like a vast amount of reasons why someone could find themselves in that situation. And oftentimes it's inevitable and it's nothing that they ever would have chosen in their wildest dreams to be homeless. And so first of all, I applaud you for your work. And second of all, I was just hoping that you could shed some light around, you know, in your work with homeless youth, if they share stories with you that you would be willing to share here, just to create some sort of vocabulary and vernacular and understanding for those listening who might feel inclined to pass somebody by on the street and judge them as choosing to put themselves in that situation.
Well, first of all, Tessa, I just want to say, I feel emotional to just because of the fact that I felt your voice cracking. I felt your lips quivering. I felt your presence really in that deep place. Oftentimes, people see homelessness as a punishment that they deserve that, you know? And so I just want to say thank you for understanding that it's, thank you just for getting it, for understanding what we're really talking about here. So there's a couple of things to understand. Poverty is cyclical. So oftentimes people don't enter poverty in one lifetime. It is something that's been going on sort of their generation, like mom was poor, grandpa was poor. So it has like a cyclical energy to it, right? So that's one aspect to understand. And another aspect to understand is the medical system in America makes it really hard for people to get care when they don't have money. If you have money, you receive care. And if you can't receive care, if you literally break an ankle and you don't have the money to get support for your broken ankle and it becomes inflamed, you take 1 week off, 2 weeks off, and then it becomes a month, your person who's hired you for that job will fire you. And then you're not only not going to have a job and you're going to have medical bills. So we have to understand that we're all, everyone, five decisions away from being homeless. And this is really important to know. And I say five, but it's sometimes even less than five, right? So these are important things to know. If you have money, you can care for yourself, pay for your medical bills, and you can get support. poverty is cyclical. And then there's another aspect of it too. It's the punitive justice system, which the word justice in that statement shouldn't be put in there, but it's part of the colloquial languaging that we use, that punishes poverty, that pathologizes poverty, that pathologizes and punishes a certain segment of society. And we're not here to look at who's doing what. I'm just here to bring awareness to systems that are currently in place that are systemically hurting those who are hurt already. And when someone goes through the prison system and come out, the systems that are at play around getting them support are nearly non-existent. Them getting a lease, impossible. Them getting a job, impossible. Them getting a credit card, impossible. All the things that it's so easy for us to do, you know, because of our record, it's nearly impossible if you have a criminal record, right? So that's important to know. So these are some simple little things for us to just be aware of when it comes to speaking about the unhoused community. Now, because I work with a certain segment, specific segment of the community, which is youth. So we're talking about like 16 to 21, maybe 22, the latest. What happens a lot there are parents who don't have the means to care for their kids, or also parents who don't agree with the child's choice. Their choice. It's not a choice. The child's blessing of being queer. So there's a lot of hardship that happens there. So a lot of kids come from different parts of the Bible Belt and they move out to Los Angeles to start a new life. And what I see is the most creative people I've ever met, the most resilient people, the most loving people, the most caring people I have ever met, and people who can hang out in paradox. That's something that we as society have been really trained to be dualistic and binary in our thinking, in our language. Now, these people can say, things are really bad and I'm okay. You know, I feel awful. But there's all these things that are working out, you know, like they can have contradictory feelings and thoughts about themselves and reality constantly. And they're not calling themselves or pathologizing themselves because they have this capacity. I believe paradox is the language of the heart. I believe paradox is the language of the soul. I believe paradox is if someone can hold contradictory thoughts and feelings within themselves, they are actually becoming liberated. That's a quality of someone who's becoming free. So the work with the unhoused, it's heartbreaking and it's deeply inspiring, you know? And it's also the kind of thing where you really learn that our presence goes a long way. Our presence goes a long way. You know, I think a lot of times people feel that they have nothing to offer. First of all, everyone has something to offer. Now, if you have an extra couple hours a week or a couple hours every 2 weeks or a month, I invite you to test your material. If you are on a spiritual path, to really see if you are really on the spiritual path, or if you are on the me, mine, and I path, which is the personal development path, then the homelessness will be will intoxicate you in a way that will just create more confusion, and you're just going to become be discombobulated. But if you are truly genuine about your spiritual liberation, the homeless youth and the homeless crisis will move you towards ideas, solutions. And oftentimes it's the same work in the hospital too. It's very much like the presence that does the heavy lifting, you know? Yeah. Sometimes I offer a somatic practice, like a breath to movement, like a body mind connection, practice. Sometimes I offer beautiful, sweet advice, but oftentimes it's you prompt them with a question and you just become so present where you literally disappear And I don't mean like physically disappear. I mean, metaphorically, all your biases, your judgment, your prejudice, all of that disappears the room, leaves the room. And all there is warmth. And so people can unravel. And in that unraveling, they find the solutions to their own burdens by you witnessing them from that non-judgmental, loving eye. And I think this is a big part of relating that we have missed the plot too, that I speak about it in the book. It's people don't know how to be how to hold paradox. Oh, this person in at work, she's so mean, but she's also generous. She brings cookies during the holiday season. She also, you know, fosters dogs from the local shelter. She's also, you know, like we need to do a better job at seeing people for more than what meets the eye. We need to do a better job.
Seeing the whole person, seeing the whole
exactly.
person.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I love that you keep referring it as test your material. Like, I think that's so brilliant. It's like, especially in LA, you know, I see a lot of people in the wellness or the spiritual community, and you know, it's all about the me, my, and I, and it's all about the personal development. It's look at me, look at what I'm doing. This is how I'm going to help you. But there's so many
manifestation. What am I manifesting? I manifest. I'm like, oh my God, you've lost the plot. We've lost the plot, you know?
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, look, we can sit here and chat with you forever. But as I said before we started, I really feel like your work really inspires so many. And I really hope that we don't lose the plot and that this continues to feed us and give us more material so that we can be more connected to our community and continue to grow together in those circles that you talk about. I think that's so beautiful. So before I ask you the final question, and I'm curious if your answer is going to be different because I've asked you before. A quiz, pop quiz.
Okay.
Where can people go to connect with you or for more information?
You can go to, if you have social media, you can go to the link in my bio or in there, you can find my new book, Spiritually We. The book's available everywhere. I would love your support with that. If you want to practice a mind-body workout, a somatic dance practice, join us in the Somatic Activated Healing Membership. We dance live on there twice a month. It's amazing. And and then also if you go to my website, sadisimone.com, you can scroll down and look at the humanitarian efforts and look at how you can actually support the homeless shelter here, orphan center in Nepal, orphan center in Indonesia, the Compassion Prison Project that offers trauma-informed languaging and support and care to prisons in California. There is lots of ways that you could get involved and find out more.
We'll add all of those links in the show notes, wherever you get your podcasts. Please check out Spiritually We. It will change you. It will inspire you. And tell us what you thought. We always love feedback. So before we let you go, Saw, we created this podcast as a place for people to come to get inspired, to feel supported. The idea is that we are all radically loved and supported by God, universe, source, whatever higher power of your understanding, the universe works for us, not against us. So the final question for you is, how do you feel radically loved?
How do I feel radically loved? Wow. Right now, today, it's through, you know, and the purpose, the message of the book is my friends, my community, literally. It's like the radically loved, yes, the universe, yes, God, yes, all these beautiful, all of that. And the way that I experience God's love is through the words of my friends, through the connection of my friends. Like the community is really showing up for me in big, big, beautiful ways. And I'm so grateful for that.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Saw. The book is called Spiritually We, The Art of Relating and Connecting from the Heart. And I just want to take this moment to thank and acknowledge your parents. I know you dedicated this book to your mom, but I want to acknowledge them for making you and creating you. And you're just such a beautiful, loving, compassionate human being. And I just am grateful for you. And thank you so much for being a part of our community. Thank you, Tessa, for your incredible questions always. Thank you all for listening. Please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get your podcasts. And again, we will see you next week. Hey friends, thank you so much for listening to the Radically Love podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps. Also, don't forget to check out the Mindful Love Hub on Substack. This episode was produced by Tessa Tovar, music by DJ Taz Rashid.